and thank you for listening to the Skeptics in the Pub online podcast. This unedited audio is taken from Atheism, Religion and Human Nature, The Evolutionary Puzzles of Faith and Atheism by Dr. Will Gervais. It was first broadcast live on Thursday, November the 28th, 2024. A video of this and many of the recordings hosted by Skeptics in the Pub online are still available on our YouTube channel. We hope you enjoy this podcast, and if you would like to support what we do, you can find us on Patreon at Skeptics in the Pub online.
Thank you so much for the lovely welcome, Kat. And yeah, let's dive in. So as mentioned, I wanted to chat a bit about research we've been doing over the last decade or so, looking at atheism and how it fits within kind of our broad scientific understanding of human nature. And yeah, my own work, I study atheism a lot. And hopefully, as you'll see, I think atheism makes a nice test case for testing our theories of how religion works and also kind of how our evolved human nature works. So I want to start out with an observation, which is that humans are really weird. We all belong to a very strange species. And, you know, it's not just that we do weird things like, say, drive nails into our heads or ski jump or form orderly cues. But yeah, we cooperate with perfect strangers. Which is something we don't see a lot of around the animal kingdom. We build buildings, we make art. And a lot of the ways we're weird, you can kind of draw parallels with things we see elsewhere in the animal kingdom. We band together into large groups and engage in warfare against each other. That's not so dissimilar from different types of coalitional kind of combat that you might see in the animal kingdom. Even things like art, you might be able to draw kind of sensible parallels to decoration among other species. But I think one domain where we could say this is something that seems to be truly unique among our species is kind of our predilection for religion. So every culture we found has had various types of religious beliefs. People everywhere seem to believe in supernatural agents, gods, ghosts, jinn, things like that. And these aren't beliefs that people hold idly. People are willing to engage in various costly and painful rituals to prove their faith in their gods. They're willing to fight and die for these beliefs. And, while religion is undeniably kind of a human universal, and it seems to be a uniquely human attribute, it's oddly enough not for everyone. So unlike a lot of other kind of species typical traits, it seems like there's a lot of people that it just does nothing for. So depending on how you slice the numbers, you could say that people who are not religious, atheists, agnostics, people who just simply don't identify with religion, are one of the largest and fastest growing religious groups in the world. And this, coming at this from kind of a broad cultural and evolutionary perspective, it makes us ask a lot of questions. So really, I think how I tried to frame it in the book is we have two different puzzles that we need to solve, two evolutionary puzzles. So first is the puzzle of faith. How is it that we became the only religious species on this planet? How did we evolve in such a way that religious beliefs find easy purchase in our minds? And then second is the puzzle of atheism. So if we've evolved to be a religious species, how come religion isn't 100% universal and widespread? And I think if you look at kind of the last 30 or so years of scientific research on these topics, you find a lot more research on the former question than the latter. So there's a fair amount of work trying to understand how religion works, and a lot less work trying to understand how atheism fits within our understanding of religion. And that's something that in my own work and in the book, I try to correct and say, we need to take atheism seriously if we want to understand how religion works and how human nature works. So the game plan for the talk, we're just going to ask, what's the deal with atheists? Where does atheism come from? How is it sustained? What do existing theories have to say about atheism? And how maybe can we change kind of our theoretical understanding of religious evolution in light of what we've learned about atheists? So let's start with what's the deal with atheists before we start considering how the study of atheism has kind of shifted the scientific landscape. So there has been a fair amount of research over the years coming at the problem of religion from cognitive, cultural, and evolutionary perspectives. You can trace a lot of this back to William James. So in 1898, he gave kind of a series of lectures that became his book, The Varieties of Religious Experience. And you might think, okay, so if that was there right at kind of the founding of empirical psychology, maybe religion's always been a hot topic. Very much not the case. So interest in religion kind of dipped off for a long time within a lot of the social sciences, especially my own kind of home disciplines of psychology. But we saw a resurgence kind of early 2000s or so. More and more people started asking big questions about how religion works, why we're a religious species. And this is nicely summarized in books like The Belief Instinct or Big Gods or Religion Explained. And it wasn't just turning up in popular books. So here's a bunch of kind of scholarly papers coming out, again, early to mid 2000s or so, talking about the evolutionary landscape of religion. One kind of recurrent theme was that religion comes naturally. It's not the case that people have to work hard to adopt religious beliefs. It just seems to be the kinds of beliefs that are good fits for our evolved minds. So here's kind of the existing theoretical landscape of 2000, 2005 or so. Religion comes naturally and easily. It's a good fit for our evolved minds. And here's just some quotes from those articles. So people would talk about religious belief as a cognitive default. In contrast, they'd say, well, disbelief is generally the result of deliberate, effortful work against kind of our natural intuitions. Or people might say, oh, atheism requires cognitive effort of some sort. Religion comes easily. Atheism takes some additional special sauce, some special cognitive resources. So if we want to summarize this, this literature would say religion comes naturally to people, whereas atheism is relatively unnatural. To really highlight that, so there's this book that Justin Barrett wrote called Born Believers, where he talks through some developmental psychology work. So psychology experiments looking at kids to see kind of what ideas come naturally to them. And he has a whole chapter in this book saying, well, is atheism unnatural? He doesn't mean unnatural in the sense that it's like weird and off-putting and bad necessarily, but he's saying that something about atheism just is harder for kind of our minds to grapple with than religious belief. And in that section, on the bottom here, you can see as a section where he says, atheism is rarer than you might think, which, you could see how that would flow from the idea if religion's so natural and atheism takes effort, then we'd expect atheism to be pretty rare. And I think this is strongly stated in this book and others that this idea that atheism might be cognitively unnatural and atheism would be rare. And it was an assumption rather than a conclusion. So here's where we can get to the part of the talk where I can say, all right, let's look at our actual research on atheism to see how well it holds up. See how well this theoretical story holds up. So let's start with what seems like it should be a pretty easy question to answer, which is just how many atheists are there? One theoretical perspective says not only is atheism uncommon, but it's even rarer than we might suspect. Okay, how many atheists are there? Does that hold up? And it turns out it's kind of tricky to count how many atheists there are in the world, because first you have some definitional issues. So first off, we could say, all right, if we just define atheism as, say, people who don't believe in a God, I think that's the easiest way to define it. We're not saying atheism is moral opposition to religion or certainty that there's no God. It's just people saying, nope, I don't believe in God. If I had to choose yes or no, I'd say no. And so Phil Zuckerman is a prominent sociologist and secular studies scholar. Back in 2007, wrote a chapter where he just tried to tally how many atheists there are in the world, and quickly kind of ran into some issues. So it turns out we don't have great data sources on this across countries in the world. It's not like countries uniformly report religious belief or lack thereof in their census reports, for example. And even large-scale polling firms like, say, Gallup or Pew, They might ask some questions about religion, but they don't always ask the questions in the same way across countries to allow like a nice apples to apples comparison. But he did his best. You know, some countries might ask, do you believe in God? Yes or no. Surveys in other countries might give people kind of a list of religious identities and say, well, check the one that applies to you. Are you Catholic, Protestant, Sunni, Shia, atheist, agnostic, or whatever else? And then Phil would try to count, you know, in this country, we had maybe this many atheists. In this country, we had this many atheists using a slightly different measure or definition. And doing the best he could, his estimate was that there might be 500 to 700 million atheists in the world. Now, I suspect that's too low, in part because, as I mentioned, there's this challenge of, well, how do we actually answer the question? How do we measure it? As well as kind of the secondary problem of, we just don't have good large-scale survey data from a lot of places in the world. But we might be able to simplify the problem a bit and say, all right, let's just pick one country where we have reasonable data over time, where we have, you know, Gallup and Pew asking, you know, sending out surveys pretty regularly using somewhat standardized measures of religious belief and disbelief. Surely we'd be able to come up with just a straightforward estimate of, you know, what percentage of people in a country like the US are atheists. But here again, we have the problem of different surveys ask the question in different ways, and you can't always translate between the numbers you'd get. So to illustrate this, if we're trying to figure out what percentage of Americans are atheists, there's different ways we could measure that. So one of them, I call this kind of the religious menu approach. And this is where, you know, we have a checklist of different religious identities, and you just ask people to indicate which identity fits them. Are you Protestant, Catholic, so on? In there, a lot of them, these polls would have an atheist box. So how many people tick the atheist box? And it turns out, so the data I'll show now are coming from some surveys that came out around 2017. And at the time, I remember seeing a flurry of kind of newspaper stories, not so much newspapers, websites were modern, right? But yeah, I'd see some press releases where, oh, there's, you know, this huge increase in atheists, because for years and years, it was about 2% of people would identify as atheists, but all of a sudden 3% are, and that's a 50% increase. In reality, it's just a little blip, but we're starting with a low base rate, so it looks big. But anyway, 2 to 3% of people would actually identify with the term atheist. So could we say 3% of Americans are atheists? Not so fast. That's not the only way we can measure it. So another approach is we could say, well, if the definition of atheist is people who don't believe in God, we could just ask people, do you believe in God? Yes or no. And you could phrase it more inclusively. Do you believe in a God or a gods? Yes or no. And we could just count the people who say no. So these people are by definition atheists, even if they might not identify with the term atheist. And here again, these 2017 results place that at about 11%, 11 to 12%. So here you can see part of the problem is, you know, just depending on question wording, we get a fourfold increase in atheism. As long as we're not using the word atheist, all of a sudden we find a lot more atheists. So we could say, all right, 11, 12% of Americans are atheists. But again, not so fast. I think this is, again, an underestimate. In part because these surveys, a lot of them at this time were done. It's a telephone survey. So imagine you're at home, you're cooking dinner or whatever. Somebody calls up and they start asking you questions, including some about your own personal beliefs. So, you know, how comfortable would a lot of people be just telling a stranger that they don't believe in God? And this is especially complicated because belief in God, especially in kind of a highly religious context like the US, it's a very socially loaded question. So to illustrate what I mean by it being a socially loaded question, there's this kind of landmark sociological paper looking at people's perceptions of atheists as kind of fundamentally outside the bounds of kind of cultural membership in America. So one way they could look at this is they do these kind of would you vote for surveys, where you say, would you vote for a well-qualified member of your own preferred political party if they happen to belong to various groups? And Gallup has been running surveys like this since, you know, the 1940s. And they add different groups over time. But you can see, you know, people, you know, 1990 on, overwhelmingly say, sure, I'd vote for a Black candidate, or a woman, or even a gay candidate, has made a lot of headway in terms of kind of cultural acceptance. But if you look at the purple line here, that's our atheist line, which at least as of these polls coming out early 2020s, it was consistently among the least popular groups. Now you might be thinking, all right, voting for somebody for president, that's a pretty high standard. It turns out, Edgell and colleagues, they also asked kind of more private questions about this. So would you approve of your child marrying somebody who belonged to these different groups? And you find roughly the same kind of pattern of results where atheists come out at the bottom. Or you could just ask people, you know, do people from this group, do they kind of agree with your vision of American society? And people would strongly disagree with the notion that an atheist might share kind of their same vision of American society. And I remember running across some of these surveys kind of early on in my grad school days and being really surprised, because at the time I was getting training in social psychology, and we had some established frameworks for understanding stereotyping and prejudice. And it would talk about, you know, we like people who are like us in some way, we dislike groups that are different from us, and we especially dislike people from groups that we're in some sort of realistic conflict with. And a lot of these key ingredients that these theories describe just don't seem to be present for atheists. So it's not an easily identifiable group. They don't have a lot of kind of cohesiveness or cultural cachet and power. So it seems like from a lot of the kind of standard social psych models, this should be a group of people that is largely ignored, not one that's scoring at the bottom on large scale surveys. So we set out at this point trying to figure out, well, what's driving people's negative perceptions of atheists? And an idea we hit on is that a lot of people seem to assume that religion is where we get morality from, and that if, you know, belief in morally concerned gods is what lets us kind of curb our worst impulses. And if that's your view of morality, then naturally atheists would be kind of sketchy. They're seen as moral wild cards. You don't have kind of an underlying basis for morality. And if that's the case, we'd predict that kind of people's negative perceptions of atheists might be specifically driven by moral distrust, as opposed to other kinds of negative emotions. Like, it's not the case that people are angry at atheists or disgusted by atheists. Instead, we were predicting that they would specifically be viewed as untrustworthy in a moral sense. And I want to show you a handful of studies that we conducted kind of looking at people's distrust for atheists. So I'll walk through the methodology first, since the next 7-8 studies all use the same basic method. So the method comes from some classic work by Nobel laureates Kahneman and Tversky on what's called the representativeness heuristic or the conjunction fallacy. So their classic example goes something like this. So meet Linda. She's 31 years old, single, very politically outspoken. She majored in philosophy in university and participated in anti-nuclear demonstrations. So you give people that description of Linda, and then you say, well, which is more probable? A, Linda's a bank teller, or B, Linda's a bank teller who's active in the feminist movement. And you just ask people to pick A or B. You could do that for yourself real quick, pick A or B. And it turns out most people pick A. No, they'll say, well, she's, sorry, they don't, most people pick option B. They say she's a bank teller who's active in the feminist movement, even though A is logically the correct answer. So why is A logically the correct answer? So every member of B is also a member of A. If you're a bank teller who's active in the feminist movement, you're also just a bank teller. So since A includes B, A has to be the correct answer, but it doesn't feel correct to pick A instead of B, because what's going on, we get this description of Linda, and then option B gives us an implied kind of group membership. It tells us, you know, she might belong to this group. And in this case, there's kind of a nice intuitive fit between the description we had of Linda, the impressions we're forming of her, and that implied group membership. So in this case, what we hear about Linda sounds like somebody who might be active in the feminist movement. The ideas fit. So that's what leads people to pick option B. But it turns out you can break this effect quite easily. You can either tinker with the description you give of Linda, or you can just plug in different implied group memberships as option B, and you'll break the effect. So imagine I gave you that same description of Linda. She's participating in anti-nuclear demonstrations, majored in philosophy, single, 31, outspoken, all of that. And then we say, which is more probable? A, Linda's a bank teller, or B, Linda's a bank teller and an avid big game hunter. Now, nothing about that description connotes somebody, like, it's not evoking the stereotype of big game hunter. So in this case, we've broken that intuitive linkage, and we'd expect that people wouldn't be inclined to pick option B if it implies that she's an avid big game hunter. And sure enough, we submitted a paper and just mentioned that the big game hunter example. And one of our peer reviewers said, well, how do you know that people wouldn't still pick option B? So we ran the study, and exactly nobody picks option B if it implies that she's an avid big game hunter. So the take home here is a lot of people pick option B if there's a tight fit between the description and the implied group membership. Fewer people pick option B if they don't fit. So that means you can use kind of how frequently people pick option B as an index of kind of intuitive fit between the description and that target group membership. So you can manipulate the description you give, you can manipulate the implied group memberships, and you can see which groups kind of evoke this fit. Since we were interested in moral distrust, we thought, all right, we'll come up with a description of our person that sounds untrustworthy. So in this case, we said, all right, this man, Richard, was on his way to work one day, and he backed his car into the neighbor's van. And some people were looking, so he got out and pretended to write down his contact information and tucked this blank note into the neighbor's van and then drove off. Later in the day, he sees a wallet on the sidewalk. Nobody's around, so he takes all the cash out of the wallet and throws the wallet in the trash can. So we've described somebody who's untrustworthy. And then we say, well, which is more probable? A, this man is a teacher. B, this man is a teacher and a Christian. So that would just, within one experimental condition, each participant just gets kind of A or B, and different participants get different option B. So we wanted to, you know, look at a bunch of kind of comparison groups that we thought would be largely trusted, and then compare them to atheists. Here, our y-axis is just how many people are picking option B, which, remember, that just tracks kind of closeness of fit between the description we gave and that group, at least in terms of people's intuitions. And nobody picked option B for the most part, kind of within margins of error. Very few people pick option B if it implies that our kind of untrustworthy guy who just committed theft and insurance fraud, if it implies that that person's Christian or gay or Jewish or Muslim. So low levels of these conjunction errors means, you know, kind of these groups are intuitively trusted. We included one group that we thought would be unambiguously viewed as untrustworthy, just to calibrate our scale. So one group of our participants would get that description of Richard backing his car into the neighbor's van and then stealing some money, and we'd say, well, which is more probable? A, Richard's a teacher, or B, Richard's a teacher and a rapist. We thought nobody would trust the rapist. And sure enough, a lot of people pick option B in the rapist condition. So now the key question is, are people in the atheist condition, are their results going to look more like sort of the Christian, gay, Jewish, or Muslim targets with low error rates? Or are they going to look more like that rapist target, our untrustworthy group? And sure enough, the people showed kind of comparable levels of intuitive distrust association here towards the atheist target as they did towards the rapist target. I still remember when we first checked the data on this first study, and this was shocking. So that was kind of our first inkling that, yes, it does seem like this moral distrust is what's driving these negative perceptions of atheists. And we wanted to expand on that and say, well, was it just something about this kind of specific insurance fraud theft kind of trust? Or does it kind of generalize to other types of moral judgments? So we wanted to use the same basic experimental setup with the Kahneman-Tversky representativeness heuristic task, but we wanted to pair kind of our atheist target with different types of moral violations instead of just focusing on the one example. So here we turn to some work from the Moral Foundations work by Haidt and colleagues, where the general idea here is they've said, well, morality is not one size fits all. Instead, we kind of have different discrete types of moral concerns. So most people would say that issues of harm are morally relevant. So don't hurt people for fun. Also, most people would agree that issues of fairness are seen as morally relevant. Don't cheat people. They also have three or four other foundations that seem to be more endorsed by people who are politically conservative, at least in the US. So this includes issues of loyalty to your in-group. Some people heavily moralize kind of sticking with your team, or issues of obedience to authority. Again, some people would say that disobeying authorities is immoral as opposed to just like not nice. And then finally, Haidt and colleagues describe a broader class of morality that they would call the purity or sanctity foundation, which is just the idea that there's kind of a natural order to the world that we shouldn't mess with. And a lot of sexual morality gets lumped into the purity and sanctity concerns. So basically, across a bunch of studies, we would describe somebody violating one of the moral foundations, and then do that same kind of representativeness heuristic game. So for example, for a harm vignette, we would describe somebody who's taking the bus home from work. And I think he mocked an obese woman on the bus. And then when he gets off of the bus, a dog comes up to him begging for food. And instead of giving him his leftover sandwich, he kicks this dog in the head really hard. So there's a harm example. Fairness example, we describe somebody who basically like cheats at cards and steals money, or for kind of an obedience to authority example, we would describe somebody who doesn't like her boss, so she like flips off her boss at work, and then she's walking home from work, and there's police, they're setting up barricades for a parade the next day, and they ask her to kind of take a detour around their barricades, and she tells them to fuck off and goes through their barricade anyway. Or for purity vignettes, again, we're stealing from Haidt here. I mentioned it's a lot of sexual morality. So there's examples of brother and sister engaging in very well protected but consensual incest, which a lot of us have kind of this cringe response. And some people would say, well, that's very, very, very immoral. Some of us would say, yeah, it's weird and gross and not for me, but not necessarily like a morally loaded thing. I don't know. Or another purity violation example from Haidt, why we have the chicken in the lower right. We had a vignette where we described somebody who's on his way home from work and he needs something to cook for dinner. So he goes to the butcher shop and picks up a chicken, gets home, has sex with the chicken carcass, and then sterilizes it, cleans it, cooks it, and eats it. Again, we all have this like reaction to that. So generally, if you're a participant in one of these studies, you get one of those moral violations described, and then we say, all right, which is more probable? A, this person's a teacher, B, this person's a teacher, and then you'd get one of these kind of comparison target groups, where we're trying to compare atheists to other ethnic or religious outgroups, just to see if it's kind of this outgroup identification that's driving it, or whether it's something specifically about, you know, atheists don't believe in God, therefore atheists might be doing this nasty stuff. Here's the result. So sure enough, for basically all of our comparison groups, and these results on the slide right now, this is collapsed across all of these moral violations. So these were each different individual studies. We'll pool them all together for now. And yeah, nobody's really picking option B for any of those moral violations paired with any of these contrast groups. However, We get people picking option B across all of those moral violations if it implies that the perpetrator is an atheist. So we describe somebody engaging in incest and say, which is more probable? A, they're a teacher. B, they're a teacher who doesn't believe in God. People pick option B. We describe, the puppy kicking example. Again, people will pick option B if it implies they don't believe in God. So this effect shows up again and again and again. No exaggeration to say every moral violation we've thrown at people, they'll pick option B if it implies that the perpetrator is an atheist. We've varied the severity of the moral violation. We've varied kind of the consequential harmfulness of it. And again, we just describe somebody doing something that seems wrong, and people intuitively assume that the perpetrator is an atheist. You might be wondering, who are the participants in these studies? So I mentioned that we're doing a lot of this work in the US, which is a peculiarly religious country. So is it the case that I'm like selectively recruiting people from the Bible Belt? Not so much. So the first set of results I showed you with the atheist versus rapist comparison, that was undergraduates at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, Canada, which is, you know, fairly secular and liberal by North American standards. And then the most recent set of results, this one, this is people on Amazon Mechanical Turk, who they're recruited from the U.S. general population, but MTurk workers, again, tend to be more liberal and more secular than general population. So it's not just the case that we're recruiting highly religious people, and those highly religious people are morally suspicious of atheists. It seems to be a bit more general than that. But again, that was just the U.S., so maybe we're looking at some weird American peculiarity. And I also mentioned that, you know, those moral violations that I showed you before, some of them are gross and disgusting, but none of them are like all that severe. And we wanted to check to see what happens if we kind of raise the stakes a bit. So we had one vignette where we tried to depict just kind of a classic stereotypical serial killer. So when a man was young, he began inflicting harm on animals. It started with just pulling the wings off flies, but then progressed to torturing stray cats and other animals. As an adult, he's no longer getting the same thrill from harming animals, so he begins hurting people instead. He's killed 5 homeless people that he abducted from poor neighborhoods in his home city. Their dismembered bodies are currently buried in his basement. Which is more probable? A, he's a teacher. And then option B here, it's split kind of randomly across experimental conditions. Half of our people would get, you know, B, the man is a teacher and doesn't believe in any gods. Half would get the man is a teacher and is a religious believer. And we took that vignette and then tried to look at how this held up across the world. So I was able to get friends and colleagues and friends of friends to kind of volunteer to run this study in their own labs. And we were able to assemble kind of a cool global data set. And what's cool is I'll put the countries up in a bit, but we were really hoping to get kind of the full spectrum of how religious these countries were that we were sampling from. So we do have some highly secular countries, Finland, Netherlands, Czech Republic, by some metrics is the most secular country on earth right now. But then we also had some highly religious places, United States, United Arab Emirates, India, places like that. So we can look and see, well, where is it that people are intuitively assuming that this serial killer doesn't believe in God? So here's the results for, you know, very few people are picking option B if it implies that the perpetrator does believe in a God. Here are the results in the atheist condition. So across all the countries except Finland, people are intuitively assuming that this kind of textbook psychopath serial killer doesn't believe in God. It's a hugely robust effect overall. And as I mentioned, it disappears in Finland, but shows up everywhere else. If you're just kind of eyeballing the stats, you'll see kind of the predictable pattern where in the more religious countries, you see a bigger effect, so bigger gap between purple and turquoise. And in the more secular countries, they get closer. But again, only in Finland does it disappear entirely. In this one as well, we also asked participants about their own individual religious beliefs. And specifically, we asked them to rate their own belief in God from like 0 to 100. So on the 0 to 100 kind of Dawkins to devout scale, we could actually, you know, plot people's results. So people are no more likely to pick the option B if it applies to their religious across the spectrum. And across the whole spectrum of individual level belief, people are still more likely to pick option B for the atheist target than the religious target. So even our atheist participants are still showing this kind of intuitive moral distrust of atheists. All right, so there's some evidence that thinking about immorality kind of naturally and intuitively gets people to assume atheism. So what about the opposite pattern? So if people are just thinking about atheism, are they going to spontaneously kind of conjure up images of immorality? I'll show you a couple studies, or I guess one study on that right now. So for this one, my colleague, Hazi Brown-Yanutsi, from back when I was at the University of Kentucky, she had this really cool experimental design to look at kind of what are people's spontaneous mental images that they form of different groups of people. So here's how the task works. We used computer software to just get this kind of generic base face that was merged from a couple of different faces. And then you could take the base face and then have it, we would generate new images by just adding random visual noise. So you can see three different kind of random images that we could generate from that same base face, where they're just degraded in slightly different ways. Why would we want these kind of weird degraded images? It gets a bit weirder. So if you're a participant in our study, you'd come in and you'd get to, for each trial, you see two of these randomly generated faces. And we'd say, all right, pick the one that looks like it doesn't believe in God. So you don't have much to go on. Neither one of them looks like much. They kind of barely look like faces. Nonetheless, people just kind of go with their gut and pick one of the faces. If you're a participant, you'd do that for 400 trials. So two faces show up, you pick the one that looks like it doesn't believe in God. That goes away, two more faces show up. So you do that 400 times. And we had almost 400 participants do this. And half of the time we asked people to pick the one that doesn't believe in God, half the time we had people pick the one that does believe in God. And what we can do is you take all of the faces that were chosen. So you pick all the atheist faces, and you can merge them together and you get a composite face that kind of shows the composite mental image of what people are choosing for the atheist. And you do the same thing for the people who are asked to choose the one that does believe in God. You'll get a composite image of kind of what people think a believer might look like. So here's the two resulting composite images. See if you can guess one of them is our composite believer image and one of them is the composite atheist image. We have atheist on the left and believer on the right. And you'll notice some kind of distinct differences between the two. But what we could do is take these two composite images, so our atheist face on the left, our believer face on the right, show them to an entirely new batch of participants. And we don't tell the second batch of participants anything about how we generated the faces. We don't say, all right, we had people kind of pick a bunch of images that they thought looked like an atheist, and that's this guy on the left. And we had people think of a believer, and that's the one on the right. Instead, we just say, here's some faces. We want you to rate these faces on different attributes. And here are the results. So as kind of a nice sanity check, people do think that the believer face depicts somebody who looks more religious than the atheist face, which is kind of cool that, you know, we generated this based on a cue of asking people to pick for religious or atheist. This generates these weird composite images, and then a whole new batch of people says, well, yeah, she, and this one does look on the right, look far more feminine than the one on the left. She looks more religious than the one on the left. But what I think is especially interesting is look at these ratings for trustworthiness or morality. So those gaps are even bigger than the gap on religion. So you ask people to come up with a mental image of what they think atheists look like, and you end up getting a face that looks immoral. And if you have people generate a face of what they think a believer might look like, they would also think that that face ends up looking more trustworthy and more moral. Pretty striking images. So there's two different kinds of results. So one, we see that if people are thinking about immorality, they intuitively fill in atheism. And second, if we ask people to intuitively think about atheism, they generate this kind of sketchy, immoral looking face. So that's the kind of psychological background to our pollsters calling people up saying, oh, pardon me, do you believe in God? It's a heavily socially loaded question. There's other research out there that atheists are well aware of kind of these negative attitudes that people hold of them. So you're asking people to self-disclose membership in a highly stigmatized group, which might lead to a situation where privately people in these surveys might disbelieve, but they would feel compelled to present as religious to the pollster. So they might secretly be an atheist, but identify as religious in the surveys. So what does this all have to do with the psychology of religion revisited? Let's go back to this number line. So these 2017-2018 results, we had a 3% atheism prevalence estimate. If you just ask people, do you identify with the term atheist? This jumps to 11 or 12% if you're looking at people who say, no, I don't believe in God. But again, you know, these surveys are generally done via telephone. So it's objectively anonymous. Nobody has to worry about the pollster outing them. But subjectively, it's not anonymous. It's still a conversation you're having with another person where you're asked to kind of publicly disclose a stigmatized identity. But you don't have to do surveys just by telephone. So you might think, all right, we could make it feel a bit more impersonal yet. And, you know, do you find comparable results if you do good nationally representative sampling, but with computer responding? So now we've cut out the kind of direct human conversation. And if you do that, you get a higher atheism prevalence estimate yet. So when we fielded two good nationally representative surveys in 2017, and we got people using the kind of yes/no metric. It was about 17% of people were showing up as atheists in our sample, doing the exact same question wording as they were getting 11% for telephone surveys. But it's possible that even people answering via computer, this might still feel kind of subjectively non-anonymous. So we wanted to see if we could find a way to estimate atheist prevalence that's even more indirect, where no individual participant actually has to out themselves as an atheist. And to do that, we found a cool measure from kind of criminology and sociology that's been used to identify kind of population prevalence estimates for things that nobody really wants to kind of publicly out themselves. So if you're studying, for example, drug use or problem drinking or various criminal activities, you could imagine that you can't just ask people like, hey, you know, do you drink and drive? Do you perpetrate hate crimes? Do you poach ivory in African game reserves? People aren't going to just kind of fess up to these things. But as a researcher, sometimes you still want to know kind of at the population level, how many people are doing these things. So there's a cool tool called the unmatched count technique or the list technique that lets you generate a population prevalence estimate without any individual person actually having to identify with whatever it is that you're trying to study. So how it works, if you're a participant in this study, we say, all right, I'm going to give you a list of statements, and all you have to do is count how many of them are true for you. And as a researcher, I would gather, you know, several thousand people in my sample, and you randomly split people into two experimental conditions. Half of the people in what I think of as the baseline condition, they just get really mundane, kind of bland statements. And, you know, the task is just tell me how many of these statements are true for you. I own a unicycle. My favorite color is red. I like hot dogs. I have pets. I brush my teeth daily. So some people are going to say three. Some people are going to say two. Some people might say one. But crucially, as a researcher, I couldn't confidently tell you which of these people owns a unicycle. I just have a number for each one. Now, remember, that's half of our participants just get kind of five bland, mundane statements. Half of our participants are in what I think of as the sensitive condition, and they're doing the same task. They're counting, they're going through the statements and telling me how many are true, and they get the same five mundane statements plus the statement that I actually care about. So if I'm studying, say, poaching in an African game reserve, I might be interested in trying to get this population prevalence estimate of how many people are poaching in the game reserve. So were I interested in that, the sensitive condition would be, you know, tell me how many of these are true. I own a unicycle. My favorite color is red. I like hot dogs. I have pets. I brush my teeth daily. I occasionally poach ivory. Crucially, nobody has to directly tell me that they poach ivory. So some people say three, some people say four. For each individual, I just have a number. But what I can do is look at the average difference between these two. Since the only difference between the two experimental conditions is that one additional item that I've added, then we can just kind of subtract the averages. So the average score in the sensitive condition minus the average score in the baseline condition should be attributed to the people who kind of fit the category of that sensitive item that I've added. So for instance, if we go back to this, if on the left, the average score is say 2.4, and on the right, the average score is 2.55, those are off by 0.15. So I'd say, all right, 15% of people occasionally poach ivory. And it's as simple as that. And so along with my then student Maxine Nahe, who's now actually doing survey research now with a polling firm, we decided to take that same basic task and use it to estimate atheist prevalence in the US. So we contracted YouGov to run two separate nationally representative samples. We did it twice just so we could tweak kind of wording and framing a little bit. And we could also do some work to look at demographic contrasts. So basically it looked like this. A third of our participants just got a straightforward self-report. Do you believe in God? Yes or no. And then everybody else was randomly put in one of those two conditions, either the baseline group or the sensitive group. Those conditions are exactly identical. You're doing this count task. It's just that people in the experimental condition on the right, they get an additional item asking about, do they believe in God? And then we do some fancy stats on that. And basically we're just looking at the average difference between our two conditions and saying, well, that's our atheist prevalence estimate. And I'll kind of show you our estimate after this from the two surveys. And I'll show you kind of how we illustrated it. We did some fun Bayesian stats that I won't get into too much, but the general idea is we'll show a little curve, and all it means is good guesses live up at the top of the curve, worst guesses live at the bottom of the curve. So here is our estimate. Looks about like that, which basically means our single best estimate for atheism prevalence in the US based on these two surveys is 26%. We could look at Gallup's estimate at the time was 11%. Well, you can look at our estimate, 99% of it's higher than that. So we can say we're 99% confident that 11% is too low. You can also look at kind of relative height here, and we could say, all right, our guess of 26% is about 20 times better than their guess of 11%. So long and the short of it, best guess of 26%, but we're also quite confident that their 11% estimate is too low. So if we return back to our number line, all right, it was 3% if we're just looking at how many people tell us they're atheists. It's 11% if we look at how many people would say they don't believe in God on the phone. It's 17% for the same question done via computer. And if we do it indirectly, now we're up over 1 in 4. We're at 26% of Americans not believing in God, if we can ask it in an indirect enough way where nobody has to kind of out themselves. What's interesting, so here is Gallup's line of when they ran this survey in 2013, 2014, 2016, and 2017, always hovering in that 10 to 12 range. here's our paper where right in the abstract we say, oh, we can say with 99% confidence that 11% is too low. Hey, oh, look at what they did since then. Correlation's not causation. I'm not saying that our silly little paper caused Gallup to revise their estimate. This likely reflects a lot of things, but I just like to point out that it was steady and then we came in. So that's just in the US. And the US is strange in lots of ways. And so it would be good if, you know, we can't kind of uniformly assume that there's twice as many atheists as are showing up in our surveys across all countries, because presumably kind of social pressure favoring religion, that varies a lot from country to country. So we're currently wrapping up a project now where we took this same basic list technique method to try to generate atheism prevalence estimates in the USA, Argentina, France, China, Indonesia, and Saudi Arabia. Which is kind of a cool bunch of countries, because we have two highly secular countries, France and China, where atheism is normative. So you would presumably expect fewer people to be hiding atheism in a place where atheism is widely accepted. But then we have countries in here like Indonesia and Saudi Arabia, where there's heavy informal and even formal kind of pressure against atheism. And the data are just rolling in now. Yeah, we ran this as a registered report, which is kind of fun. It's a tweak to the publishing model where instead of us running a study and then kind of shopping it to journals to see who wants to publish it, instead we went to the journal and said, here's our plan for the study we want to run. Here's why we think it's important, but we haven't collected the data yet. And the journal at that point signs on and they say, okay, we believe in your methodology. So if you report the stats as you say you will, we'll publish it. Which is great for a project like this, where, you know, we just want to show, hey, using this method that we think is solid, here's the estimates that we'll get. So I'll show you the results. This stuff is not quite published yet, but should be out soon. Here's our six countries. And so our atheism prevalence estimates, if we look down at the bottom, USA is slightly higher than those 2018 estimates I just showed you. So both self-report and indirect are a bit higher. But if you look across the countries, you'll see in every country, the indirect estimate is higher than self-reports would get it, which just means in all of these countries, we're finding evidence that there are atheists who are not showing up in our surveys. I think we had some issues with non-representative sampling, especially in Saudi Arabia. So both self-report and indirect are higher than I think the true value is. But notice how large that gap is between the self-report and the indirect measure. I also think this is an interesting graph to look at, because even in China and France, we're seeing more atheists on the indirect measure than are turning up on a self-report, which just seems to show that it's fairly general that we're seeing people not disclose atheism. And it's interesting. So there's kind of the actual numerical breakdown. But one way to look at the divergence between indirect and self-report is say, all right, if we assume that the indirect estimate is kind of more accurate than the self-report, we can say, well, what percentage of atheists in the sample are not disclosing it via self-report? So that's this little column over here, where in France and China, it's not that many people are sort of our closeted atheists. Only 6 or 7% of the atheists are not showing up or not identifying as such. But that jumps to 20 to 30% in the other four countries. And in this survey or in this study, we also had a measure of how much people report that there's social pressure to be religious. So on the little graph on the top, further to the right, these are the countries where people are saying there's a lot of pressure to be religious. So Saudi Arabia, Indonesia, USA. On the left, we have China and France, where people are saying, nah, it's not a big deal if you're religious or not. And then the y-axis is just charting that kind of percentage of atheists undisclosed. And we see basically the pattern you'd expect. So in places where there's a lot of social pressure favoring religion, that's where we're seeing a lot of atheism going underreported. So if we pop back now, here's our number line where kind of as things get more and more kind of safe for people to identify as atheists, up to that indirect task where nobody actually even has to identify, we see that our estimates of atheist prevalence get higher and higher and higher. This is a problem, though, because as I mentioned, kind of established theory coming from early to mid 2000s is saying that atheism is rare. Atheism is something that must be kind of, it's cognitively unnatural. It takes special cognitive resources to maintain atheism. And here's, you know, a fairly widely read book in this area saying atheism is rarer than you might think. I mean, I don't think so. I think it looks like actually quite the opposite. It's like atheism is a lot more common than we've been assuming. It's more common than our best kind of gold standard surveys are showing us. And it seems to be something that instead of atheism is something that requires cognitive effort to be sustained, instead it looks like people are effortfully concealing their atheism from others. So kind of in the concluding chapters of my book, I draw on a bunch of this science to say, well, the more we learn about atheism, the more this is changing our view that atheism isn't cognitively unnatural. Instead, it seems to come pretty easily to people in a lot of different contexts. And if anything, atheism is probably more common than we've been, more prevalent than we've been assuming. So again, returning to kind of these two puzzles that I framed at the beginning of, you know, how is it that our species has religion, yet within our religious species, we also have atheism. I think the best solution, and it's the one I try to spin in the book, is that we just have to look broadly at kind of our dual evolutionary and cultural inheritance. That's just how we work. And I can go a bit more on that in the Q&A if you want, but in the meantime, thanks to friends and collaborators along the way. I'm also going to throw in a plug here where if this kind of big picture evolutionary and cultural thinking sounds fun, at Brunel, we have a master's program actually specializing in this that hopefully we're in the midst of revamping the curriculum. If you got any questions about that, give me a shout out. And in the meantime, all of that science I just talked about and more is in the book. So we have here, you know, it's endorsed by my dog, as well as Dan Barker, Sean Carroll, and others. So thank you all. That was a lot of fun.
Hello, and welcome back. I hope you're ready for our Q&A. So we're going to start with our traditional question. Will, do you have a pet? And is your pet an atheist or an agnostic?
Absolutely. So I'm going to grab my pet real quick. And she will come say hello. Oh, this is Lucy, everyone.
Hello,
it's thanked
Lucy.
In the book. I think she's atheist and agnostic, we'll say. Oh,
okay.
Yeah, she's
so
all excited.
Leads us on quite nicely to the question of, like, how do you tell that an animal is atheist or agnostic? Like, you say humans are a uniquely religious species. How do we know that?
Yeah, I think that one, since we can't directly perceive mental states of animals or even each other, we kind of have to take our best guess just from behavior. And it could very well be that there are religious animals out there, but if so, their religion is different enough that it doesn't show up in the same behavioral residue we'd guess. They keep it private and secret.
Okay, lovely. Our next question is from Anonymous, and they ask, do you differentiate between agnostics and atheists, or are you assuming they're the same thing?
So I'm really glad this question came up. And there's a section in the book where I try to make the case that essentially agnosticism and atheism are not mutually incompatible at all. And in fact, they're answers to fundamentally different sorts of questions. So atheism versus faith or belief is a question of metaphysics. So do you think there's some sort of a God thing out there? Whereas agnosticism, that's an answer to a question about epistemology. So can we know whether there's a God? So you could be atheist, you could be agnostic, you could be both, you could be neither. And in the book, I talk through some ways we're trying to actually measure that in our surveys that we're sending out, where we're trying to feel like, are people high on agnosticism or atheism or both, and what might that predict? So I think, yeah, we can kind of productively think about atheism and agnosticism as answers to different questions. Now, following from that, what would I do with, you know, am I treating atheists and agnostics as separate if I'm, say, trying to come up with a population prevalence of atheism? There, we try to default back to just asking people about their beliefs. Do you believe in a God? Yes or no? And we might collect data sometimes on religious identity. So does somebody identify as agnostic versus atheist or something else? But a lot of the time, that's kind of secondary importance to me. What's interesting is we've done some work looking at kind of the research from the first half of the talk on people's negative moral perceptions of atheists. So do agnostics get a pass? It turns out as soon as our participants figure out that agnostics are people who don't actively believe in a God, they get psychologically lumped in with the atheists. So lack of belief is sufficient for moral distrust, it seems like.
Okay. It sounds like, so we're talking very specifically about a lack of belief in God. That's kind of how you've defined atheism. It puts me in mind a little bit of like the whole problem of defining religion and the Buddhism problem, because obviously, like, I think most people would happily agree that Buddhism is a religion, but it doesn't necessarily involve a god or gods. So how do you deal with basically the Buddhism problem while trying to study atheism?
Yeah, that's a great question. So one way that's been handled in the literature, so I, full disclosure, I haven't done much work directly with Buddhism, but I know some other people who do work would say, well, kind of doctrinally and officially, Buddhism doesn't have gods, but informally on the ground, there's a lot of kind of beliefs that go along with a lot of Buddhism that look a lot like gods. Not universally necessarily, but that's something we have to keep in mind studying not just Buddhism, but any religion, is oftentimes there's a vast chasm between kind of what the official stance is and how it actually gets practiced on a day-to-day basis. So in this book, Big Gods, by my doctoral advisor, Arunayan Zion, he talks about traveling through kind of heavily Buddhist countries and seeing these eye spots painted on walls. And that's Buddha's eyes. It's like, well, if we're not supposed to believe in a God, then why is he watching me? So again, that's just that gap between kind of official stance and religion on the ground.
Yeah. Okay. It's almost like studying humans can get a bit messy.
So I've heard.
Our next question is from Eagle. And he asks, do people who have negative images on atheists have the same response to other religious people, especially if it's a religion that disagrees with theirs?
Yeah, that's a great question. So if somebody's down on atheists, might they also be down on sort of like rival religious groups, or at least differing religious groups? I suspect a lot of the time the answer would be yes, although for potentially different reasons. With atheists, it really seems to be the intuition that if these people don't believe in a God, what's keeping them honest? What's keeping them moral? Whereas there's actually some decent evidence now for trust existing across religious groups, where if I'm a Christian and I meet somebody who's, say, a Muslim, I'm not going to agree with them on lots of things, but I can infer kind of some of their moral norms, and I know that they believe in a God who's monitoring their behavior. So in some contexts, we see trust across religious lines, and you might still have conflict, but it's not this same kind of heavily trust-based type. So it might be more of a dislike, or if it's competing groups, then you've got this realistic conflict and you can get things like anger. So yeah, you might get dislike for different reasons, I guess.
Yeah. Okay. Our next question comes from Melanie, and they ask, how does using another term like humanist compare to these? Does it evade any of the negative bias, or do people still distrust that?
So I actually have never directly used humanist as a contrast in our studies. And I think that would be a good starting point, because it's not just a negation. It's not saying here's something these people don't believe. Instead, you can kind of flesh out more of a secular worldview and philosophy and how the world works. You'd hope that would kind of put a bit more of a positive glow on things. one kind of empirical downside. So we did have one study where in response, we had a reviewer who said, well, it's not the case that people distrust atheists because atheists don't believe in God. It's because atheists don't belong to a moral community. And this is a researcher who spent a lot of time writing about moral communities. So obviously he was like, well, your idea has to actually be my idea. So we ran this study where we described somebody who either does or doesn't believe in God, and that was independently manipulated from they either do or don't belong to a moral community, where we give the vignette and you say, you know, they hang out with their peers and they discuss kind of the way the world works and they have firm moral commitments and blah, blah, blah. And then we do kind of one of these conjunction fallacy distrust studies. And it turns out that we could describe this kind of fully fledged secular worldview and moral community, and people still distrusted them as soon as they found out that they don't believe in God, at least on the sneaky indirect task. So that's kind of the bad news on that one. But it is just one little study.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, based on what you said earlier about as soon as people realize that agnostics are also not really believing in God, they lump them in with the atheists, and I'd assume we'd have a similar problem with humanists as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And my favorite illustration from our studies of this, like people being willing to say, well, the atheists are just across the board bad, is we had an example where we were trying to get people to, instead of assume that this moral villain was an atheist, we were trying to come up with an example where we thought, all right, how are they going to potentially infer that this person's religious? So we actually described, it was like a child sex abuse scandal. We describe a vignette of this guy works with children in the community. He's been working with him for years. And then after decades, it's come out that he's been abusing children the whole time. Which is more probable? A, he's a priest, or B, he's a priest who doesn't believe in God. And when we ran that study, people actually assumed that he was a secret atheist priest.
Okay. On that note, our next question is another anonymous one. And they ask, you had many studies for evil equaling more likely to be atheist because religion equals a moral code. Are there many in the other direction, or are we drawing conclusions from one study or one paradigm?
So for the other direction is, are we inferring kind of sketchy immorality from atheism? So we had the FACE study, which I included just because it's kind of a fun, vivid illustration. By now, we do have some more studies where it does seem like people kind of infer sketchy moral character from atheism and not just the opposite.
Okay. Our next question is from Paul, aka Picticule, and he asks, in your research into perceptions of trustworthiness of atheists, have you established a method of determining the actual trustworthiness of atheists?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. And incidentally, when I presented some of this work in my doctoral dissertation and in the defense, one of my examiners said, well, isn't it perfectly rational to trust religious people over atheists? I thought that's weird. But then he unpacked it. And so his rationale went something like this. So if I want to trust somebody, I'm just assuming that they're going to choose not to do something bad, more or less. And we've all got lots of reasons for not doing bad things. So we might have our own internalized moral codes, but we also have judgment of our peers. We also have to worry about legal sanctions. And the religious person just has one more reason. So we all share these ones, but the religious person has one more. So shouldn't we trust the person with more reasons to not do bad things? And so in the book, I have a whole chapter where I try to say, all right, let's actually look at the evidence on can we trust atheists? Are they any less trustworthy? And tried to look at it through a few lenses. So I looked at kind of cross-cultural comparisons where you look at places with more atheists and, you know, are they dens of iniquity? Not so much. They're doing just fine. Or we could look at, there's some really cool research by Willem Hoffman and Mark Brandt and Linda Skitka and a couple other authors on that one, where they gave people kind of like a smartphone app that would just ping them a few times throughout the day and ask them questions, and it included questions about, you know, what's going on morally? Have you recently done anything moral or immoral? Have you witnessed something moral or immoral? Has somebody done something moral or immoral to you? And so they just tried to get these snapshots of people's everyday morality. They're published results on this. They also had kind of information about participants' own levels of religiosity. And there was no difference whatsoever between the most religious and the least religious people in terms of committing moral or immoral actions, or even being a direct recipient. Their only differences were that in terms of like hearing about it. So people who are less religious would hear more gossip about immoral stuff. But in terms of actually committing or being on the receiving end, no difference whatsoever. Also walk through some stuff on kind of people's intuitive moral judgments, which again seems pretty much stable across religious and non-religious respondents. So where you do find a difference, it's kind of in terms of how people are conceiving about morality. So if we go back to the moral foundations theory, where it's like some people say morality is just harm and fairness, and other people say, well, it's harm and fairness and loyalty to your in-group and respect for authority, and also all this weird, like, don't have sex with the dead chicken stuff. On that, it looks like kind of religious morality is full spectrum. It's all of the foundations. Whereas to atheists, they really do focus on the harm and fairness, which isn't so much saying that the atheists are less moral. It's just they're conceiving of morality in kind of more utilitarian, consequentialist terms.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I'm wondering a little bit whether there's any relationship between the neurodiversity and the tendency to look at things in a more utilitarian way. Because I know there is research suggesting that neurodiverse people sometimes tend to be more atheist. Like, do you know of any research looking into that, or have any thoughts around that?
So there's a little bit of research looking at neurodivergence and atheism. Some surveys. Yeah, what's interesting, actually, I just saw a talk on this last summer, I guess, by Ingo Vasuri, who actually does really cool work looking at people on the autism spectrum and religious beliefs. And she finds that I'm trying to remember how exactly she put it. Basically, it wasn't a total absence of religious belief, but it seemed to be more like idiosyncratically personalized religious beliefs as opposed to these like communally shared ones. As for how that translates into sort of utilitarian moral thinking, I could see it, but I don't know the research well enough to confidently say.
Yeah. Okay. Our next question is from Igor again. And he asks, when we talk about atheism, we talk as if being religious is the human norm, and being an atheist is something you have to become. Is that just cultural bias?
Yeah, I do think it is largely just cultural bias. And it's cultural bias that you see seeping into the research literature sometime, where, you know, I was reading and reviewing a paper the other day talking about how people opt out of religion. And it's like, well, why is the assumption that everybody was opted in the first place? And you can see that a bit in kind of how it's contrasting the story I'm telling in the book about atheism comes naturally in lots of cultural contexts with this older view that, you know, religion is so natural that atheists must be, you know, these heroes of rationality fighting against religious intuitions, which I don't think that idea has held up that well. But we're so used to talking about religion as a baseline. And I think it's a lot more productive to think about just prevailing cultural circumstances. And in a lot of kind of specific societal circumstances, atheism is going to be the natural default. People are never going to develop religious beliefs in the first place. In a lot of other contexts, the opposite will be true. It just so happens to be the case that throughout human history, we've had those conditions more often. So religion's been more common, not because it's necessarily a default position, but those are the conditions we've lived in where it comes a bit easier.
Yeah. And I wonder how much of that narrative is because we need to pat ourselves on the back a little bit, because it turns out no one likes us, but at least we're clever.
I do. I think that's a lot of it. So that sort of religion comes naturally and atheism is unnatural. That strain of research has for a while been embraced by some sort of like new atheist writers. And I think it's because one, you can say, well, like you were saying, we're clever. That's how we're atheists. And yeah, it feels good to say that, right? The research hasn't backed it particularly well, but sure, it's a compelling name.
Okay. So Anonymous asks, how we define atheist? Not believing in supernatural beings higher than humans, or no belief in the supernatural at all, including afterlife, demons, etc.?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. In most of my work, I try to define it pretty narrowly. So an atheist is just somebody who doesn't believe in a god. There's other work out there where they try to distinguish that from something like, you know, hardcore strict materialism. There's no gods, there's no spirits, there's no souls, there's no good luck charms, there's none of that. And it turns out that that kind of hardcore kind of rationalist materialist view tends to be a lot less common than just atheists. So we get a lot of atheists who, you know, might have a good luck charm or they believe in fate. People can hold a lot of kind of spooky, supernatural-ish seeming ideas without necessarily attributing it to a god. Then there's also another kind of cool line of research where some people have taken these strict materialists and bring them into the lab. And it turns out if you ask questions indirectly or put people under time pressure, it looks like there might be some kind of like latent underlying intuitive spooky-ish beliefs about souls or mind-body dualism, or people might kind of intuitively hold beliefs that they might not explicitly endorse.
Yeah. Do you have a sense for why that is? Like, why is that kind of strict materialism and lack of any sort of superstitious supernatural beliefs, why that is so rare in humans?
If I had to hazard a guess on that one, I'd say that's pretty rare, in part because we do have some just reliably developing intuitive presets that seem to come with the human package. And we have separate cognitive systems, for example, for tracking other people's mental states as we do from tracking physical objects. And if you've got two separate mental systems tracking different type of stuff, it's pretty easy to then intuitively think, well, there's different kinds of stuff out there. There's mind stuff and there's body stuff. And so, oops, now I believe in souls. And that came quickly just because that's how our minds work. And then it's not necessarily the case that people are developing fully fledged, you know, religious worldviews from that. But I think it's easy enough to start developing those beliefs that then they can be culturally elaborated pretty easily.
Yeah. And certainly like that mind-body dualism feels very intuitive. Like every now and again, if you sit and think that my thoughts are just coming out of a weird fatty lump of electricity in my head, it like it starts to get a bit strange. You do feel separate.
Yeah, and like the academic understanding that's probably what's going on, just it really does not match the subjective experience of consciousness particularly well.
Our next question comes from Igor again, and he asks, do you only look at survey data, or do you also try and gauge religiosity by any secondary metric like church attendance, for example?
That's a fantastic question. And it's one I haven't done the work, but there is some really great work out there. If we loop back to what I was talking about, how our atheism prevalence estimate gets higher as you kind of ask it more indirectly, the same thing, at least in the US, shows up with church attendance, where if you ask people, you know, how often do you attend church or other religious services, and you give people, you know, I go once a month or every couple of weeks or every week or more than once a week, You get a lot of people saying, I go at least once a week. But then if you give people a daily kind of time use survey for a month or so, where each day they just record, like, did you do these things? And then tally up how often people actually said on a given day, yes, I went to church. The rate's far lower for people to do this like day reconstruction method. Church attendance looks a lot lower. Or you can, there's also been some work where you could do peer report. So you ask me how often I go to church and I say, oh, I'm there twice a week. And then you ask my buddies from church, like, hey, how often did you see Will? Turns out they see me a bit less than I've let on. So I think one report I was reading, somebody said, you know, if everybody in the US went to church as often as they say they do, we'd actually need more churches.
Right.
There's just not enough room for everybody to do that much. There's a lot of churches in the US.
Yeah. And I suppose it harks back to that kind of difficulty and strangeness of trying to study humans, because even if you are tracking church attendance, well, it doesn't mean that somebody is like cognitively engaging with all of it while they're there. You know, like if we sort of take the example of Homer Simpson versus Ned Flanders, like they're engaging in the same behavior, but the like the internal feelings about it are wildly different. And you know, that they're cartoon people, obviously, but like they're based on how human people behave. Like you get that with humans.
Absolutely. I'd imagine, you know, you have it going both ways, where people are over-reporting how much they're actually there, and also some people who are there, but mentally they're, you know, they're already running errands or thinking through the afternoon's football match or whatever.
Yeah. Our next question comes from Anonymous again, and they ask, are there similar studies for other countries, like the UK, which is less actively religious, but many people wouldn't actively bother to say that they don't believe?
Yeah, so I've really been trying to expand, like my kind of template over the last 4 or 5 years is whenever we find a weird, quirky effect, so whether it's the people distrusting atheists or the undercounting of atheists, we'll find it in one place and then I try to expand it. So we're in the midst on that. And I'm trying to think. So UK is less actively religious for sure. We don't have the atheism prevalence ones here yet, but I'm trying to launch that. In terms of work on kind of moral intuitions about atheists, we find that even people here in the UK who identify as atheists themselves still might harbor some suspicion of atheists. And there's a whole other study that, for time reasons, I took out of the talk, but we have one that's probably going to be published in the next couple of months, where we found that people kind of were intuitively skeptical of other atheists. And here, the sample of countries we had, it was like Sweden, Canada, Vietnam, Czech Republic, UK, Japan. So we actively sampled more secular, less religious countries. And even in those countries, people who identify as atheists are still intuitively looking suspicious of other atheists. The effects get smaller in these places, but they don't disappear and they don't reverse, which is also interesting.
Yeah. Our next question, it's another anonymous one, and they ask, what drew you to this subject?
Oh, that's a fun one. So I think growing up, I was always curious about religion. I didn't grow up particularly religious, but I knew it was around. And I like reading about different world religions. But I never thought of it as something I could actually study. And I also was like a student who bounced between things. And even psychology is like the third major I tried out in university. I didn't have a clue what I wanted to do. And it was really when I was starting to apply to graduate schools, looking at evolutionary and cultural approaches to behavior in general, where that was the first time I connected the dots. And I think I ran across, might have been like Pascal Boyer's book, Religion Explained. And that was the first time it clicked for me that, like, oh, religion, I've been kind of idly curious about it. And I also wanted to do this evolution and culture stuff. And that's when it clicked that I was like, oh, I could do the evolution and culture stuff on the religious stuff. So that's when I first made that connection. And then kind of this specialism in atheism. I was, you know, at the time I was reading books about atheism. I was listening to Atheist and Skeptics podcasts. Y'all are my people. Yeah, it was really seeing some of the survey results on people in the U.S. saying, no, I wouldn't vote for an atheist for president. And I kind of had another one of these aha moments where I was like, well, I'm interested in the atheism stuff and I'm doing the religion research. Why don't I just do the atheism research? And there was very little research out there. So it kind of felt like a wide open frontier and been exploring it for like 15 years now.
Yeah. Throughout those like 15 years, are there any sort of results that you feel like, or that you can remember where like your jaw just dropped and you're just blown away by the results?
Yeah, I mean, so the first set of graphs where we had the sort of atheists weren't intuitively trusted more than rapists, that was one where, you know, I was still a grad student at that time and I was like, what the what? And the effects were massive. And so we replicated it and replicated it again. And then as we just kept throwing other moral violations at it, it was still the same reaction every time. I was like, okay, so it's not just insurance fraud. They also think atheists are capable of incest or cannibalism or, you know, necrobestiality. Anything we could throw at it, we kept getting the same effect. So over time, it got less surprising on an individual study basis. But then when you put all of the studies together and you're like, you know, holy crap, it's all these things people just assume atheists might get up to. So that one kind of stopped me in my tracks. And then the first time we looked at the indirect measures of atheist prevalence, I was expecting it would be higher, but I wasn't expecting that at a time where Gallup was saying 11% that we'd turn up 25%. I thought it might go from like 11% to like, ooh, 15%. It's higher, but I wasn't expecting we'd return an estimate that was like more than double what the top polling surveys or polling companies were saying.
Yeah. Okay, and that leads us quite nicely on to what's going to be our last question of the night, which is another anonymous one. And they ask, so how can we fix our atheistic image? Can we use your research somehow?
Yeah, this is a tricky one. And I think there's a lot of different dynamics that go into the poor atheist image. So one, because atheism is a concealable identity, and as we were seeing there, there's more atheists out there than most people realize, which means there's a lot of people out there who simultaneously hold negative kind of intuitive perceptions of atheists while interacting with atheists all the time and having no problems. They just don't realize that they've been interacting with atheists. So I think visibility, is one key part of it, where I think if a lot of people just realized, you know, I'm interacting with atheists all the time and they're no better. They're just people like anyone else. And so I think that's the second important part is if we look at kind of, you know, if a lot of people out there are interacting with atheists without realizing it, well, when are they definitely realizing that somebody's an atheist? A lot of perceptions of atheists will be heavily driven by the most prominent atheists out there, which over the last 20 years or so means a lot of people's image of atheists will be like a Dawkins style religion's awful type, which that's not going to help the image either. So I think what will really help public perception of atheists is not necessarily for people to think, oh, atheists are like, they're the rational ones, or, you know, atheists, oh, I saw them, they're actually moral. I think people, just by kind of being more openly atheist, but also being kind of like normal and chill about it, that'll create an image of like atheists are just like anyone else. I think that should be the target, is like no better, no worse. They're just people. I've been hanging out with them all the time and it's not a big deal.
So basically we need to go outside and talk to people and be nice to them.
It is weird, right? It sounds
awful. I'm not sure we're up to the task. Okay, wonderful. Well, thank you so much for that talk. And I've been reading your book. I can highly recommend it. I've been enjoying it. Thank you very much. And That's it for another evening and for another year. And finally, I'd like to thank Matty and Igor, who are our tech wizards tonight, and thank Gerald, who was also working away behind the scenes, helping me to sort through your questions. And of course, thank you all for tuning in, and we hope you join us again soon. Bye.
Thanks.
That was the Skeptics in the Pub online podcast. For more skeptical content, including information about future talks, please like us on Facebook, follow at SITP on Twitter, or head to our website at sitp.online, where you'll also find a link to all the ways you can get in touch with us, including our Discord server. Music in this episode was provided by Thula Bora and used with permission. Until next time, thanks for listening.